I got Michael Smith in the chair, and he's got a great chair. Michael is sitting in one of those winged back chairs. So it's almost like you've got your own little built-in podcast studio, Michael.
Yeah, I don't think I planned this. I bought this chair several years ago, but now that I work for NPR, I guess you could say it's very apropos.
Very apropos. And you had to move that chair, or did you buy it in your new home when you took the job with NPR?
You know, I actually haven't moved yet. I still live part-time in Western New Jersey in a small town called Califon, and then also part-time in New York City. NPR is working remotely through the end of 2020, and that means kind of good and bad news. I mean, good news is that I don't have to move to the DC area at least until 2021. The bad news is that we're working from home and I haven't met actually.
Well, it's nice to see you no matter where you are. Hey, it's E.B. Moss, and this is episode 15 of Insider Interviews with the Chief Marketing Officer of NPR, National Public Radio. Michael Smith joined back in April. Many years before that, he and I worked together at Food Network, and he went on to run the Cooking Channel and digital channels for Scripps Networks. And Michael is just an excellent marketer and also has a real finger on the pulse about digital and all things diversity. He's a caring guy. I know that he biked to work in New York City for 14 years in a row. Now he's going to have to drive to the NPR offices when he moves to the DC suburbs, I think. That's okay. Michael's moved around a lot. He was born in Canada. He was raised in Jamaica. He worked at Disney Channel in Asia. So Michael knows a thing or two about the world and certainly about marketing. Here's Michael. Michael Smith, I have to first say congratulations, and you definitely stepped into an amazing role as CMO of NPR, as we mentioned, but we also joked about the fact, not very funny, that it was at the start of our global pandemic. So I really want to know what your challenges were before that was even on our radar and what you intended when you accepted this role. And then how you had to pivot your marketing strategy.
Yeah, you know, I think the big challenge for NPR, which is the challenge for most media companies right now, is dealing with these two shifts going on in the media industry. One is how people consume, moving from linear to more on demand and streaming digital products. And then two, the change in the demographics, how the country is becoming more diverse than ever in history. And NPR, late last year, started to realize that focusing more on digital distribution of content and reaching younger and more diverse audience were two key priorities. And we had started to actually make investments into doing what we call off-platform marketing. What makes people be surprised to hear is that for years, NPR had not done any paid media advertising or very, very limited advertising. Then we'd relied on just cross-promotion across radio shows. And then the radio shows begat the podcasts, and then we cross-promoted across them. But it gave us a very loyal audience, but a very limited audience. And so I think that in order to broaden the audience, we needed to go off air. And we also realized that we needed to grow our digital audience because radio is relatively strong, but it's been declining little by little as people move to more on-demand platforms. What the pandemic was, a couple of things. One, it accelerated the shift from linear to digital, because one of the key ways people listen to the radio is in their cars, and now they're not commuting. So we saw an immediate drop in our news magazines, our morning and afternoon show listenership, but we saw a huge spike in the NPR.org and our podcast listening. So actually our total audience for all of our touch points is greater than it was before the pandemic started, but our radio audience has declined significantly. So that's one thing. And then the second thing was that the advertising recession hit as well, which we're lucky that we have three key revenue streams, membership dues from supporters of the local stations that carry our content, philanthropy from foundations and major donors. And then the third part is from sponsorship revenue. But the sponsorship revenue was hit pretty hard. And so that really hurt us in terms of being able to make the investments we wanted to make in paid media. So it put a lot of those plans on hold. But we have been still, in a lesser way, but still investing in supporting some of our podcasts with paid media. So it's a tricky balancing act, because with tighter revenue, there's less resources, but we just think it's so important to continue to drive awareness of our digital properties, just because that's where the audience is moving.
There's so much to, as they say, unpack in that answer. We will drill down to each of those things. But here's what I think I heard you say and what I want to get the details on. So first is the sort of balancing act between linear and digital. The other is the shifting audience makeup with greater diversity, but sort of shift in the age demo. The third is the impact on your lifeblood, your very support from various forms of income. And so how are you going to balance all of that? So I know you for a long time now, Michael. And so I can say with some authority, and not just from reading your bio, that you are the man for the job. So,
well, I think, yeah, I was meeting with our news desks this morning and I was giving them a little background, just my personal history. And I was saying that one of the reasons I think I'm well suited for this is just the fact that I've just been a huge fan of the content. Our mission is to create a more informed public, one inspired and invigorated by stories of events and ideas and cultures. And so if you're that kind of person like me who just always, you know, loves reading biographical novels and listening to podcasts and taking online classes, and it just sort of always been about personal enrichment. And that's what NPR does. That kind of we feel is our role in the media landscape. And I tell people it's like being a fan of a team and then you get to sit in the dugout, you know, and then you actually get to get on the field and play. So,
oh, yay.
So it's been a real treat.
Well, here's why I think you're going to hit a home run. See how I did that? Yeah. So the reason I know you is because something like 20 years ago, can you believe it? 20 years ago, this was ironic. You and I worked together when you were the SVP of marketing and creative at Food Network. And I was doing ad sales marketing at Food Network. And then 9/11 hit.
Yeah, it's true. That was probably the last, maybe other than the 2008-9 recession, probably the biggest shock to our industry in the last 30 years. Yeah.
And now I'm interviewing you in the midst of, I shouldn't laugh when I say this, a global pandemic. So, but in between, and why I say I also know that you're the perfect man for this job, is I remember you, Michael, really helping to evolve so many of the digital assets at Food Network that then you went on to be the GM of Cooking Channel and really kind of took on all of the expansive programming for that brand and its digital presence. And then you were the GM of digital channels for Scripps. And you had to really kind of come up with stories to reach, again, younger, more diverse audiences. So that in and of itself, you know, as I said, I know you personally and professionally, you're so well suited for this. What are you most excited about taking on at NPR of those sort of buckets that we outlined?
Well, I think the thing I'm most excited about is the challenge that we face and the resources that we have. Before I came to NPR, my initial thought was that we would need to kind of build it before they would be able to come, that we maybe would have some content challenges in terms of creating more diverse content with younger voices and younger storytelling. And then once we got the house built, then we could lean into actually inviting people over to the house. But I was just been blown away when I look at the content that we have internally. If you think about the diversity that we've been able to infuse throughout NPR over the last 5 or 6 years, from our flagship radio shows like Morning Edition and All Things Considered, half of the hosts of All Things Considered are women of color, and a quarter of the hosts of Morning Edition are people of color. There were many reporters. When we think about our podcasts, whether it's Code Switch or It's Been a Minute, the stories or the through line or some of the episodes and the stories that we cover throughout all, from Hidden Brain to How I Built This, there's just a huge amount of diverse content across everything we do. The challenge is that our awareness is really low because we haven't done marketing. We've been sort of like almost like an elite university in a way. One of those things where, like, if you have to ask, you don't come, you know?
Yes.
So I think people are surprised when they come, and pleasantly surprised. That we did some research last year that showed that an unaided awareness, when we ask people, you know, the name, the top, their favorite, or just even news brands they've heard about, brands like CNN or ABC are in the 60s or 70% mentioned, but NPR is down in the 30s. And when you ask people of color, it's down in the 20s percentile. So that to me says that there's a huge amount of people that just don't think of us and we're not top of mind or have never heard of us. Another data point is that we find them as people move the customer funnel, as they become more engaged and start using the brand, among regular listeners or regular users of our brand, when we look at it as people of color versus white listeners, people of color actually, their satisfaction levels are actually higher than white listeners. So it's an exciting thing in the sense that if we can just get more people to know that we're there, then they can get us into the consideration set. When they come, I think they're going to love it and they're going to be really engaged.
Well, that's so interesting because, of course, being a child of the 60s and public radio, I definitely know and love the NPR brand. But NPR is comprised of a lot of different pieces. So perhaps it is the NPR brand that you're working on building awareness for, just like maybe for a Wondery with Podcast Network is, you know, a destination, what have you. But so many of its components are so well known, like Morning Edition, or more recently, How I Built This, or, you know, so many of the shows. And you rank so highly on the most downloaded or listened to podcasts on almost any poll, whether it's PodTrack or Chartable, et cetera. So the components are known. And how are you leveraging that?
Yeah, the components are known, but oftentimes people don't put the pieces together. Like, for example, Tiny Desk, which is a hugely successful YouTube music series that we do. We have, I think, over 4 million subscribers to the series. But often people will be surprised that it's from NPR. They'll think, oh, I saw that John Legend concert. It's fabulous. And then, oh, that's NPR. That's the same people that also do the politics podcast. So I think it is.
So they were so cool.
Yeah. Creating this connective tissue between all elements of the brand. One of the things that's, I think, held public media back is the lack of focus on the sort of faces behind the microphone. People, we've tended to market the brand just as NPR itself, but we haven't really highlighted our constellation of basically some stars, you know, star journalists and reporters, the way that other media companies have. You know, when you think about most popular nonfiction brands, it's a blend of the brand and the personalities. You think of Food Network, but you also think of Bobby Flay, you think of Rachel Ray, you think of HGTV, you think of the Property Brothers, you think of Chip and Joanna. You think of CNN, you think of Anderson Cooper, or Fox News, you think of Sean Hannity. And NPR, it doesn't roll off the tongue when you say NPR and, you know, name three stars. And I think that's just been because there's been a lack of focus on that. I think people have had their heads down just doing the great work that we do and not self-aggrandizing people in NPR, but it's just changing the mindset that putting the personalities out there, it's not about elevating people for the sake of stardom, but it's more giving people emotional hooks that they can get into the brand more when they relate to personalities. And especially when you're talking about attracting younger and more diverse audiences, when they start to know that there's a Gene Demby or a Sam Sanders or like the host of Throughline or the host of Pop Culture Happy Hour, some of these shows where there are young people, young diverse hosts, that just creates so much more engagement than when they just see the three block letters NPR.
There is a story that I would love to sort of memorialize about the caliber of NPR stars. So you and I have one other stop along the way in common, which is that I was the past managing editor of Media Village, and I invited you in to be a contributor quite successfully, and much to the pride of Media Village, you did so. But my first story as a contributing writer there several years ago, I hadn't been a journalist in a long time. And thank you, Jack Myers. He gave me the opportunity to freelance write at first. My first assignment was to interview Guy Raz, who was then the host of TED Radio. And he was so charming and so charismatic over our conversation. And it happened to be over dinner. Michael, I completely forgot that I was supposed to be a journalist. I was so taken by Guy Raz and his chit-chat manner and ability to be so charming, I hadn't written anything down. So that was my first story back as a journalist. I've learned since then. I took copious notes before I interviewed you, even though I've known you for a while. But I'm a big fan of NPR talent.
Yeah, there are so many people like Guy that they all share. And then maybe this is also getting into the brand essence, is this sort of curiosity and this belief that the more you know, the better person you are. And the more other people around you know, the better people they are. And that just creates a better world for all of us to live in. It's like we use this analogy that, like, we're doing it now with COVID. You know, we're saying everybody should wear masks because it just makes it safer for all of us. I think it's the same thing where if we're just more aware and informed about the world and the cultures that we live in, we're just going to be nicer to each other and just have more civil discourse. The world will be a better place to live. And so that's kind of the mission of why we're here.
Well, NPR also has done a lot with the times that we're living in. And I was actually talking about media consumption habits during COVID lockdown and all of that, as you referenced earlier, with a media consultant friend of mine, Howard Humana. And he said, when I listen to NPR, it's almost like my brain feels like it's working differently, like there's a space to it. And I know exactly what he means, because when I play my news brief in the morning, and I swear this is going to lead to like a two-part question, I hear the back-to-back hard-hitting news headlines, and then I hear the NPR style, and I kind of mentally exhale. So I want to know how you and if you market for that. And then I also want to talk about the content that NPR is putting out around COVID and how that's evolved.
Yeah, I think that it gets back to why public media exists. The Public Broadcasting Act of 1967 was created, I think it was 67 or 69. That's one of the things about working at NPR. I noticed I've been doing some interviews. And when I worked at Food Network and I would make a slight mistake in an interview on a date or something, nothing would happen. And now at NPR, I get like 50 emails from people at the company saying, we're fact-checking you, which I think is great. It speaks to the reason why we're one of the most trusted news brand out there. But the reason, yeah, the public media was supported by the government and created was to fill the gap that commercial media is challenged in. When you're driven by the purely commercial goals of advertiser revenue, then it does lead to that, if it leads, it bleeds kind of mentality, that you've got to make content that's going to get people to click as many times as they can, watch as often as they can. And we're not driven by that. You know, we're supported by millions of wonderful members who are not paying for any particular show. They're contributing to support an enterprise, a venture of the kind of storytelling we do. And that allows us to make the kind of storytelling that they want. There's a deeper dive, a more civil and balanced look at issues rather than what commercial media can often be pushed to do, which is scream.
You literally can build in the spaces because you don't have to shout and you just want to tell the story properly in both senses of the word.
And I think when you through your second point about COVID, the reason why we've been so, I think, useful to people during COVID is that this is a time where you don't want the screaming and the shouting. You actually want to take a second and know, well, what should I really do? What does this really mean? What's going to happen to my job? What should I wear a mask? Should I not wear a mask? Should my kids go back to school? Should they not? Is it safe to go to a grocery store? And if you want to come to places that you can trust, that take a beat to actually think about and give you the best information possible.
So the other element in that long question I asked before was speaking about my voice assistant. I won't call her by name or a lot of them will chirp up. But moving on a little bit to the tactical, how focused are you on the strategy of voice versus audio overall, like radio and podcasts in your marketing efforts?
I think it goes back to our overall priority, which is to diversify our audience to better serve and reflect really America as a whole. That's sort of our uber guiding principle. America is right now is about 40% people of color, and our audience is only on radio, it's only about 20% people of color. So we have some work to do to really fully serve the entire public. That's our number one priority. And then we look at everything through that filter. And so when you talk about voice assistants, one of the things we know is that digital touch points like voice assistants or smart speakers, social media platforms like Instagram and TikTok and YouTube, they tend to over-index on use by people of color. And so thinking about how to grow that diverse audience, being on those platforms and letting people know that we're on those platforms is important to us.
That's so interesting. So it's not just about reaching more people, or as we say, you know, you have to be everywhere the consumer is, but it's because there is a portion of the demographic that is important to reach and that they are skewing more diverse in those areas. Got it. Didn't know that.
I think, you know, when we think of ourselves, you know, we're a mission-driven organization. If you go back to the mission of one of the authors of the founding NPR mission statement, a guy named Bill Simmering wrote or said often that NPR is about sowing seeds. It's like sowing seeds for a better public and a better America. And so you have to evaluate how well we're doing, not the way a for-profit company would be, where it's, you know, what's your revenue or what's your total reach or users. It's really how well are we fulfilling that mission. And so we see it as we've done a really good job with a certain part of the audience. There are big parts of the audience that we haven't reached yet. And so that's what we need to do to feel good about why people come here, which is to fulfill the mission.
Well, a lot of that proof of concept is in, I think, the evolution of some of your content. So back to the COVID-related information and being a trusted source and fact-checking, I know that you had launched Coronavirus Daily. Is that still, I mean, that took off immediately because of that trust, I think. And is that still a bona fide show, or has that evolved as our crisis has evolved?
Yeah, the Coronavirus Daily is part of what we call our daily habit strategy. If you go back to the sort of Uber framing that people are moving from linear to on-demand audio more, a few years ago, we said, okay, well, we're really instrumental in people's lives in the linear world with a morning drive time show, a morning edition, and an afternoon drive time show called All Things Considered. As people want more on-demand audio, we need to create products that will fit their lifestyle, morning product and ultimately an afternoon product. And so up first was the morning product, which is, you know, one of the most popular. It's in the top five of all podcasts. And it basically serves the purpose of what Morning Edition does for people who want a more on-demand, on-the-go experience. And then when we thought about the afternoon, just a combination of the timing of what was going on in the world, that it made sense to make the afternoon daily habit all about coronavirus, because that was what people really, what country was focused on. As the pandemic has extended and there's less, say, day-to-day breaking news, we've actually evolved Coronavirus Daily into a new podcast called Consider This, which is sort of serves the role that All Things Considered serve. It's a sort of afternoon wrap up the day daily podcast. It's hosted by Kelly McEvers, who hosted Coronavirus Daily, but now she's joined by several people from the All Things Considered team as well.
That's interesting also. So you're not only looking at how content is consumed sort of like on the continuum, but also by day part, and you're adjusting your programming strategy to take all of that into consideration.
If you think about everything from the daily that the New York Times does to our podcast, I think people are seeing how people consume, you know, it used to be you'd read the morning newspaper, and then, you know, we got on the way home from work, you'd pick up the evening newspaper, and that was maybe to watch the nightly news. And the world has evolved to where there's still people who are listening, you know, watching linear morning news broadcasts and afternoon ones, but especially among younger people, they want more flexibility digitally, they want it on their smartphones. And so we've just had to evolve our product portfolio to serve that habit.
Now, sticking to the tactical side of a chief marketing officer, where your focus is, to be real specific, are you also putting a focus on the NPR One app?
Yeah, the NPR One app is our sort of owned and operated app where you can experience live streams from your local public media station, on-demand content from our podcast, and other audio content all in one place. I think it's similar to what's going on in the OTT streaming market. For video, is the best way to reach people through your own owned and operated app? Is it through distributing through third-party platforms? I think we have a blended strategy. We get a lot of listening to our podcast on Spotify, obviously, and on Apple Podcasts. A lot of our audio is listened through our individual station live streams through their websites. So there's a mix of different ways people consume. I think our overall strategy is we just want to be where people are and where and how they want to consume. And so it's still unclear how it's going to shake out. Are people going to consume on-demand audio and podcasts mainly on third-party platforms? Or are they going to go to owned and operated apps? I think it's still early innings before we know.
That third bucket I want to come back to. Now, I know that National Public Media, NPM, is really your sponsorship arm. And Back in the day, I had the opportunity to speak with Gina Garubo a few times, and that might not necessarily be your area of focus, but I want to get your opinion and your approach, if you've been able to work with NPM and kind of leverage or be the antidote to the anti-Facebook kind of scenario and leveraging that trust. How do you interface with NPM as CMO of NPR?
You know, Gina Garubo and Brian Moffitt are two people who I really admire and are fantastic. And I work very
Me too.
really closely with them. And I don't think it's an understatement to say they've really built the podcast advertising category. I mean, really pioneered it. But we work closely with them in terms of just as a creative services sort of agency, you know, supporting the messaging and marketing that they do to sponsors. And then also strategically, one of the things we need to do, at least I believe, is that to increase our reach and awareness among audiences that don't know us, we need paid media, but we also need more partnerships and opportunities to partner with other brands who have reached the audience that we'd like to be in front of, and see how we can barter and trade and exchange audiences and do more partnerships. And so doing partnerships with sponsors is a great way to do that, as you know from your background as well. And so I've been talking to Gina and Brian a lot about ways to do that more, and they have great ideas of ways to bring sponsors into, you know, branded content that helps get us in places in front of people that we don't normally reach and help sponsors extend their reach. So yeah, we work very closely together.
That's cool. I guess you're going to have to find some way to replace what had been a really great effort with live events. I mean, speaking of Guy, he used to sell out when How I Built This went on the road, for example. So have you found a magic bullet to replace that kind of presence these days?
Yeah, live events was a really growing one. It's great, obviously, for brand engagement, but it also was a great revenue generator for us. It's definitely on pause right now, although we are doing lots of virtual events. How I Built This has a new series called Resilience, which is a special online-only video series that Guy's doing. We just did a Tiny Desk contest, which is something that would have been a live event where the winner would have gone on a live tour. Instead, we turned that into a live online series. We actually got even more entries than we normally did for the ordinary one. We got 6,000 entries, and we just picked a winner this week. So
it wasn't me.
Did you submit an entry?
I'm just saying, yeah. Always the bridesmaid.
I'm sure within a few months, it'll be time to enter the 2021 contest. So
okay.
But that's true because, yeah, I know you're a pretty accomplished jazz singer. So
thank you.
We'll see you next year. The events, though, definitely it's going to be a while before they come back. And I'd say at least into 2021 or 2022. But I think they'll be a huge part of, continue to be a huge and growing part. And in the interim, we have a very robust virtual slate of events that we're continuing with.
To just kind of complete or flesh out our other bucket about diversity and what's going on in the world and how NPR can stand up as the kinder, gentler form of media, I'd love to know a little bit more about its role in the landscape today, and if you have hope for the future in terms of diversity and inclusion, and any of your favorite examples of what you've seen coming out of NPR.
Yeah, I think that we know millennials and Gen Zs, and it's really encouraging, I think even greater than previous generations across all racial backgrounds, are more concerned about social justice than previous generations, which is really exciting. It means they really want to dive into these topics and understand them in a less partisan, sort of like you said, screaming back and forth, but really understand the stories and understand the history. And that's what we do. A couple of months ago, around 4th of July, we did a video where our NPR Visuals, which is an emerging part of the company, which makes visual content that you see on our Instagram page and on YouTube, and which is one of the fastest growing touch points for us. They made a video where they went back and found Frederick Douglass's great, great, great grandchildren and filmed them actually reading a speech that he had given back in 1852, talking about the need for freedom and emancipation. And so it was really moving, like 9-minute film featuring all these various descendants reading that speech. And within 24 hours, we had over 3.5 million video views across Instagram and Facebook and YouTube on the video. And it just was a sign to me that people are hungry for that kind of content. What do you expect? I think a lot of older people would expect from NPR. But what's exciting is that younger people are finding our Instagram page, which is now over 3.5 million. They're finding our YouTube content. So I think we're the perfect brand and we have the perfect kind of content. We have a podcast coming up in maybe about 6 weeks from now, which is going to be all about the intersection of hip hop and the criminal justice system. And it's a really unique look hosted by two reporters from the NPR music team, Rodney Carmichael and Sidney Madden. And it's going to take a look at the interesting intersection historically between mass incarceration and hip hop music. It's the kind of content that we're doing that, you know, zeroes in on issues that I think are really interesting and important to people of color.
Thank you for that, because again, I rest my case that you seem to be the right man for the job and have influenced change already. It's a lot of uptake on Instagram, just as one example too. I'll let you wrap it up with your personal hopes and optimism or pessimism for the future, Michael.
I think I'm very optimistic about the future. If you're talking about just, you know, America in general, because on these issues of racial justice, I think people will see it when you look at the marchers and the protests that have been going on, very different than the way it was in the 1960s. It's a very multiracial group. And actually, in many of these protests, the majority of the people protesting have been white Americans. And for so long in America, it has been the more marginalized and excluded groups of people, whether it's African Americans, Latinx people, you know, LGBT people, who have been arguing to be recognized and having almost to pull on the hem of the dominant culture to be noticed. And this time around, when you look at Gen Zs and Gen Ys, and maybe it's because of so many, if you're under 30 years old in America, you know, most of your adult life, you live with a Black president. So you grew up in an America where your favorite athletes were LeBron James and Tiger Woods, and your favorite musicians, you know, were Beyonce, your favorite actor was Will Smith, your president was Barack Obama. And so when you see things like George Floyd happening in your country, when you're young, you kind of feel, I think, more outrage and shame than maybe those of us who are older, who have kind of lived in America with these injustices for such a long time, and maybe we've become a little bit accustomed to them and just not as outraged. So younger people, I think, are just saying, well, wait a minute, this isn't the country that I want. And so I think that they are going to make a change the way that previous generations didn't completely do. So I'm excited.
And NPR will be there to cover it and capture it and evangelize it, which is great.
Yeah, like we have all along. I was talking to Bill Simmering, who was one of the founding program director. He created the show, All Things Considered, back in 1971. And he talked about the first episode, and the majority of the show was spent covering the Vietnam War protests, marching in Washington. And he said that that's where we started, at the middle of social unrest, and kind of giving a unique view into that time. And then now 50 years later, we're at the forefront of explaining what's going on in another, you know, time of social unrest.
Tremendous. Michael, thank you. Did we leave anything out? Because I know you have great points of view.
No, I think we'll have to do it again in the next.
Oh my gosh, I love that you invited yourself back on, and I'll take you up on it. That's great. That's a compliment to me, and I'm flattered that you would want to. So thank you so much for being here. Michael Smith, CMO of NPR. You're the best.
All right. Thank you, Evie.
Well, I hope you got some good inside scoop from this episode of Insider Interviews with me, Evie Moss. And I also hope that you'll rate, review, subscribe wherever you download your podcasts. You know the drill. Apple, Stitcher, Google, iHeart. Thanks again for listening.